All right, Genesis chapter 50 here this morning. Genesis chapter 50, we're going to wrap up this book here this morning. As we wrap it up, it's helpful to think about where we started at, to a degree. And where we started at was by laying out two main themes that we see throughout the book of Genesis. So when we've had foundations and faithfulness up here for all of these weeks and months that we've been doing this, it's not just because it sounded good. It's not just because they both start with the letter F, although I am partial to things that alliterate like that. It's not for those particular reasons. It's because it captures what is the essence of what is going on in this book. We are laying out foundations, and we are just seeing the faithfulness of God throughout this book. As we've gone through this book, we have seen the foundations that have been laid for us. Some of them are more obvious. Some of them are more life-changing, so to speak. We're thinking about creation. We're thinking about marriage. We're thinking about, and we'll think about again, the covenant that is made with Abraham today, right? These are foundational elements. These are foundational truths that are found in the book of Genesis, and they continue to have an impact throughout the rest of the Bible, right? They are seeds here, and those seeds continue to grow. It's a thread, if you want to look at it that way, and that thread continues to be interwoven throughout all of Scripture. You continue to see those things present. There have been some that are less obvious. As we find ourselves here this morning in Genesis chapter 50, we have an understanding of why we find Israel down in Egypt at this point in time. When you get to the book of Exodus, that's extremely helpful, right? Why are we starting off there? Genesis is laying the foundation of that. Why don't we hear about the tribe of Joseph ever? Well, last week we found out, right? We know why you don't hear about the tribe of Joseph. It's because of the way that Jacob has blessed the two sons of Joseph. Why does Christ come out of Judah? Right? These are perhaps less interesting truths, not less interesting, but less you know, world-changing truths, but they are foundations that need to be laid. When you get to the Gospels, you know he can come from the tribe of Judah. He should come from the tribe of Judah because of what you have seen here in Genesis. These foundations are pivotal. These foundations are important, and they continue to be laid out. We've also seen, though, the faithfulness of God throughout the book of Genesis. We have seen a lot of bizarre situations. We have seen some grotesque situations. We have seen great evidences of sin throughout the book of Genesis. And yet God's faithfulness continues to be present and continues to be evident. We have seen how that the faithfulness of God has allowed for Abraham and Sarah to have a son. Right? God made a promise, and as time went on, it doesn't look like that's going to happen. But it does happen because God is faithful and he keeps his promises. We have seen that God has preserved the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. He has preserved all of them through external threats that have come against them. The threats of war that have been around them, the threats of famine that have more recently threatened their lives. God promised that he was going to keep them. God promised that he was going to give them the land. God promised that he was going to bless them and grow them. And he has done that, and he has kept them alive in order that those promises could be carried out. We have seen going further back that God has never flooded this world again. He did it once, right? And the sinfulness of man is certainly great enough that you could justify flooding the world again, but he's never done it again, right? Because he made a promise to Noah back in Genesis that I will not ever flood this world again, right? It may be destroyed in another way, but it won't be destroyed by a flood again, right? God has made a covenant, he has made a promise, and he keeps those promises, and he keeps those covenants. So we have seen both foundations and faithfulness as we've worked our way through the book of Genesis. And so it's fitting this morning when we come to chapter 50, as we start to think about what is going on in this chapter, it's fitting that you see both of those themes yet again, right? That both of those ideas come out, that both of those ideas are expressed, and we're able to look at that. And so there's two foundations that we'll look at here this morning, and then we'll look at how those foundations are wrapped up into the faithfulness of God, and that's how we'll wrap up this book here this morning. Before we do that, and before we start reading, let's start with a word of prayer. Father, we come to you this morning, and we're thankful. We're thankful that we have had the opportunity to study this book. We're thankful that we have been able to think through what you have laid out for us, what you determined should be laid out for us. Father, there are answers that we don't have in this book. There are things that we may wonder about. There are questions that could be asked, and you don't bother to deal with those. And that's because we don't need to know some of those things. Father, but what we do need to know, you make sure that we have it. You make sure that it's explained for us, Father, and we're able to be edified. We're able to glorify you. We're able to understand you, Father, and approach you in a way that is meaningful because of what you've done here in Genesis and because of what you've done throughout the rest of Scripture as well. And so, Father, I pray that we come to you this morning with a sense of gratitude, that you are a God who reveals yourself. You are a God who lets yourself be known, because that is the only way that we could possibly know you, and that's the only way that we could approach you. So, Father, we thank you for that this morning. Father, I pray that as we look at Genesis chapter 50 here this morning, that we see you, that we understand who you are, that we understand that you are a God who is faithful, who keeps his covenants, who keeps his promises, and that, Father, as we see that lived out in the lives of the patriarchs, as we see that lived out in the lives of their descendants after them, Father, that we take comfort in that, that we trust you more, that our faith in you grows because we have seen that you are a God who keeps those things. So, Father, give us grace for that this morning. Give me grace as we work through this passage to think clearly and to speak clearly. And, Father, I pray that you are glorified through all this. Just then, I pray. Amen. So, before we get started in chapter 50, let's go back to Genesis 49 very quickly here this morning. As we are looking at the foundations that are being laid here in chapter 50, I left out last week verses 28 through 33 of chapter 49. There was already so much present, we had to drop something, and this was one of the things that had to be dropped. But it doesn't. Genesis chapter 50 makes very little sense unless we deal with those last few verses there. The first thing that I want us to see this morning, and it starts in verse 28 of chapter 49, is that we are laying the foundation for a return to the land. Okay? We're laying a foundation to the return for the land. This will take place both in the lives of Jacob and in the life of Joseph as well, more prominently in the life of Joseph, but Jacob is evidencing this as well here. So if you look with me back in chapter 49 and verse 28, this is following everything that Jacob, all the blessings that Jacob has given to his sons, right? We saw last week that not all of those were as good as what you would want. All right, some of those, if you got blessed that way, you would say, no, please don't do that again. Right, those are not good. But some of those were very good there. But after he has finished dealing with all of the sons there in chapter 28, verse 27, with Benjamin being the last, in verse 28 we read this. All of these are the 12 tribes of Israel. And this is what the father said to them when he blessed them. He blessed them, everyone, with a blessing appropriate to him. Then he charged them and said to them, I am about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought along with the field from Ephron the Hittite for a burial site. There they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah. There they buried Isaac and his wife Rebekah, and there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in it purchased from the sons of Heth. When Jacob finished charging his sons, he drew his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. Chapter 50. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. Now 40 days were required for it, for such is the period required for an embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. When the days of mourning for him were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, If now I have found favor in your sight, please speak to Pharaoh, saying, My father made me swear, saying, Behold, I am about to die. In my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me. Now therefore let me go up and bury my father, and then I will return. And Pharaoh said, Go up and bury your father, as he made you swear. So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of the household and the elders of the land of Egypt, and all the household of Joseph and his brothers and his father's household. They left only their little ones and their flocks and their herds in the land of Goshen. There also went up with him chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great company. When they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, they lamented with a very great and sorrowful lamentation. And he observed 7 days mourning for his father. Now when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, This is a grievous mourning for the Egyptians. Therefore it was named Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. Thus his sons did for him as he had charged them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham had bought along with the field for a burial site from Ephron the Hittite. After he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers, and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. a very large and a very grand procession, isn't it? Right? Everything taking place from Genesis 49, verses 28, all the way down to verse 14 here in chapter 50. All of this stems from what is Jacob's last wish, right? That is what all of this is flowing from. Jacob has a last wish, and it is very simple. I want to be buried with my fathers, right? All of this is going back in Genesis to earlier on in the book of Genesis when we were looking at the death of Sarah. And as Abraham is sitting there in the land of Canaan, and he has no land to his name whatsoever, right? Nothing at all. Even though God has promised him that he is going to give him the land of Canaan, Abraham owns absolutely nothing. All of his time in Canaan has been spent sojourning, living over here, living over there. He seems to eventually settle more around Hebron and really puts down some roots there, seems to get some allies there, but he doesn't own anything. And you remember that when Sarah dies, Abraham has to go to the people of that city and say, I need a place to bury her. I don't have any land to my name. I don't own anything. I don't have a cave to stick her in. I don't have a grave. I have absolutely nothing. I need some place to bury my dead. And at that point in time, Abraham apparently had scoped out a spot. This looks good. And approached Ephron the Hittite, as his name is mentioned several times in this passage, and says, let me buy this land from you. And Abraham buys the land. Up until the point that Jacob will settle in Shechem for his very short stint there, that is the only piece of land that any of the patriarchs own. Even at this point in time, all they own is that piece of land and a little piece of land outside Shechem. That is all that anyone of this family owns in the land of Canaan, despite all the promises that have been given to them, right? But Jacob now looks at his sons as he's getting ready to die, now that he's blessed them all, now that he's pronounced the things that are coming, and says, I want to be buried with my fathers. I want to be buried with Abraham, and I want to be buried with Sarah, and Isaac, and Rebekah, and I want to be buried with my wife, Leah, as well. You may remember that it seems odd that Leah is the one that he wants to be buried with. Rachel is the one that he loves more and is closer to. But Rachel is buried somewhere else, right? Because of the way that Jacob was sojourning, it wasn't feasible, and he wouldn't be with everyone else if he was buried where Rachel was. So he's going to be with Leah, which many see as kind of a justice, right? She really was the first wife, and it was a little bit unfair of what Jacob had done. But this is Jacob's final request. I want to be buried with my fathers. I want to be buried there in Hebron. And this puts then a burden on the rest of his family to carry out this wish, right? And remember, they're all down in the land of Egypt, right? This is not going to be an easy journey. This is not something that's going to take a short period of time where you just jump in a car and drive up there. There is going to be a lot of effort that has to take place for this to happen. And this is exactly what leads us into chapter 50, right? The execution of that wish. What Jacob wants is going to be carried out. In chapter 50, verse 1, you notice there, Joseph is present there, able to close his father's eyes. This was one of the things that God promised to Jacob. As Jacob was getting ready to leave the land of Canaan to go down to Egypt, he promised that Joseph's going to be there to close your eyes, right? Which was a comfort to Jacob. This was the one that he loved. This is the son that he prized and treasured more than any of the others. And Joseph, verse 50, chapter 50, verse 1, he is present. He is right there, just as God had promised for him to do. Jacob, in essence, gets a state funeral, a state burial, as it were. It's odd because, and as you look in verses 1 through 3, you don't expect Jacob to be afforded this kind of honor. Jacob is not a pharaoh. Jacob is not an Egyptian nobility. Jacob is not a priest. Jacob is, as far as Egyptians would be concerned, a nobody from the land of Canaan. Now, the only thing that brings Jacob any status is who? It's Joseph, right? Joseph is the one that brings Jacob any status whatsoever. And so it seems reasonable then that the reason why you see this state funeral, the reason why you see, end of verse 3, and the Egyptians wept for him 70 days, that has more to do with probably with Joseph than it has to do with Jacob. But at the same time, what an honor that is for Jacob, right? To be buried in this kind of way, to be mourned for this in this particular kind of way. We'll notice there that the weeping is for 70 days. Chances are that we are looking at a combination of the 40 days that was meant to embalm him there at the beginning of verse 3, and then probably 30 days that's additional on top of that, right? So there's together that brings about 70 days total rather than 40 plus another 70, which would be a very long time, right? So Joseph, so Jacob is mourned. All of Egypt is mourning Jacob. All of Egypt is interested and concerned with his passing. Verse 4 then, Joseph begins to try to figure out how can we make this happen, right? And I think part of this is probably due to the fact that, that Joseph has to be sensitive to a couple factors. Number one, Joseph has a role to perform in Egypt, right? Joseph is not just a nobody that could just kind of take some time off and it's going to be okay. Joseph is second in command to Pharaoh. And by and large, Pharaoh is using Jacob to run pretty much the entire country. To have that individual step out for a good period of time to go up to the land of Canaan is kind of a big deal, right? That this is something that's going to be a little bit unusual. And so this probably explains some of the back and forth that's taking place there in verse 4. You'll notice there that Joseph does not go to Pharaoh himself and ask. He sends someone else, right? When the days of mourning for him are past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, "If now I have found favor in your sight, please speak to Pharaoh," saying, right? Joseph is not the one that is doing the action here, right? He is talking to the household of Pharaoh, saying, "Can you go to Pharaoh? Can you ask for Pharaoh to let me do this thing?" And probably part of this is Joseph's role. Joseph knows this is sensitive. Some commentators have speculated that this could partly be a fear that Joseph might leave and go back to the land of Canaan and forget Egypt altogether, right? That there might be some concerns about that. By this point in time, the famine is long over, right? The famine is done. The famine has been over for a while. So the immediate reason, the immediate cause for having Joseph there is over. It could be seen as an opportunity to Joseph say, "Listen, I did what I told you I was going to do. I got you through this famine. I'm out of here," right? And I'm going to take everyone with me. And some have looked at some of the details here, right? You see at the end of verse 8, the little ones and the herds are still present. Some have even looked in verse 9 at the chariots and horsemen as being not only a form of protection, but being a form of making sure that Joseph really does come back down to Egypt, right? We need Joseph, and we're not going to let him play hooky, right? He's going to have to come back when this is over. So that's entirely possible. It's entirely also possible that you notice there when it calls out when the days of mourning for him were past, that there may have been some kind of a tradition that indicated that because he was in mourning, he wasn't allowed to or shouldn't have spoken to Pharaoh anyway. So this may have been some kind of a tradition. Some have pointed to when you look later in Israel's history, and Nehemiah is afraid to come into the king's presence because he's crying. Right, because he's distressed, and the king doesn't want to see that. The king doesn't need to see that for whatever reason. Right, there may be something similar that is going on here. Joseph is still in a form of mourning. It's not appropriate to go in and see Pharaoh. Pharaoh wouldn't allow him to come and see him in that particular situation. And so there's a need for intermediaries there. But whatever that is, Joseph is trying to get these wishes that Jacob has professed to come into play. And so he sends to Pharaoh to say, "Listen, let me go bury my father. Right, let me go bury my father. Let me fulfill his wishes. Let me bury him in the land of Canaan and give me some time off, in essence, right? Let me do this." Pharaoh is pleased with this. Pharaoh says in verse 6, "Go up and bury your father as he made you swear," right? Go do this thing. Make this thing happen. And apparently he not only said make this happen, but he sent a lot of people with him. Right, you'll notice that list of everyone that goes with him. Verse 7, Joseph went up to bury his father and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of the household, all the elders of the land of Egypt, and all the household of Joseph and his brothers and his father's household. Combine that with verse 9, there also went up with him chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great company. Right, that seems to be a very fitting description of exactly what is going on. Pharaoh not only says, "All right, Joseph, you can go up, you can go bury your father," but Pharaoh sends people with Jacob to make this a grand affair. What probably is happening, we're probably talking about mid-level and higher nobility that are going with him to make this an official affair. Jacob's already been given that state funeral there in verses 1 through 3, and this simply continues that, right? We are going to continue to honor Jacob. And probably by virtue of that, we are going to continue to honor Joseph as well. They send horsemen. They send chariots to make this a big deal. Again, part of that is possibly because we want to make sure Joseph comes back. The other part is this is ensuring that there is no interference with this party at all, right? This is a long journey. This is a dangerous journey. There are plenty of things that could go wrong. We're talking Egypt here. This is a state affair at this point in time. How do you make sure that your nobility, how do you make sure that your second in command is safe and is secure in the middle of hostile territory? You send enough people to make sure that you don't want to mess with this group of people right here. Right? So this is a projection of power on Pharaoh's part, on Egypt's part, and it's a way to make sure that everyone is secure, everyone is safe as they journey along this way. As they make their way up, they come in verse 10 to some place that is called the threshing floor of Atad. The threshing floor of Atad. It's very difficult to know exactly where this place is. The best guesses that most people have from tradition are that this is somewhere around the city of Jericho. Okay, so very near to the Jordan River, but on the west side of the Jordan River, still in the land of Canaan. You would suspect that because in verse 11 we find that the Canaanites are present. Okay, Canaanites live on the west side of the Jordan River, not on the east side of the Jordan River. So it seems likely that this is where they are. Now, what's curious is the way that they might get up there. Okay. You'll notice there, as the description is laid out for us in verse 10, it says, when they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan. Now, that's helpful, isn't it? Beyond the Jordan. What do you mean by that? We don't know, right? Because that could mean different things depending on where you're standing, right? If I'm on one side, I say it's beyond the Jordan. If I'm on the other side, I say it's beyond the Jordan, right? We don't know exactly where this is, which means we don't exactly know the route that they took. The reasonable route to take would be simply to go hug along the coastline up from Egypt up to the land of Canaan. That was the road of the kings that went up that way. That is the reasonable way to go up. But the fact that you have to call out beyond the Jordan makes you think that there's something else that has been going on there. Either they have, and many would actually think then they actually came up along the west side, along the east side of the Jordan River, and then crossed over at the Jordan River at some point, or as they came up the east, they went down around the Dead Sea and then came up to where Jericho is. Either is possible. If they came up the way that many think that they did, which is to come up along on the east side of Jordan and then cross over, they're basically mirroring the path that the children of Israel would take 400 years later. And there's a lot of interest then that starts to take place at that point. It's almost as if you're doing a dry run, almost as if you're doing a rehearsal for something that's going to come 400 years in the future. But it's very difficult to say, right? But here at the floor of Atad, they then stop and they spend more time to mourn, right? More time to mourn. You'll notice there that they observed another 7 days of mourning that are present there. And this mourning is loud. This mourning is loud. Because in verse 11, when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, this is a grievous mourning for the Egyptians. Therefore, it was named Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. The Canaanites that were in the land, the Canaanites that were present, saw what was going on and said, oh my goodness, what is going on over there? What tragedy has befallen the Egyptians? They mourn like this. And it strikes them so much, they are so impressed by what is going on, they decide, we're going to name the place after that. Right, and so they call it the brook of Egypt or the mourning of Egypt. Abel is you can kind of be twisted in either which way, and might be intended as a play on words there. Right, this is the place where Egypt was. This is the place where Egypt mourned over the loss of someone. Right, this was noticeable. This was significant, and everyone understood this was a big deal. Chances are then after those 7 days are finished, that's when we come to verses 12 through 14. It seems as after those 7 days of mourning gets carried out there at the threshing floor, then Joseph and his son and his brothers finally have enough privacy to be able to take Jacob and bury him privately. Okay, probably leaves the rest of the company there at the threshing floor, journeys a little bit farther, and there in verse 12, thus his sons did for him as he had charged them, for his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abram had bought along with the field for a burial site from Ephron the Hittite. So chances are they're finally able to get away. The official mourning is over. All the state funerals are done. We've embalmed him. We've got him in the place where he needs to be. We've got him into the land of Canaan. And they're finally able to take him to that cave and bury him the way that Jacob has wanted to be buried the entire time. Right? This is a big deal. This is a big deal. And you'll notice that Moses spends a lot of time on this. Right? This is significant to Moses. Right? And the question becomes, why? Why is this so significant to Moses? Why is this so important, right? And it's because of this land, right? This land is important to this family, right? God has promised to this family, I am going to give you this land, right? How do they get it? When do they get it? Will they get it, right? These are questions that remain, and Jacob's funeral points towards that. It points towards that reality. Here is yet another patriarch who has died. He's buried in the land, but he is now deceased, right? Will they get the land? Will they not get the land? Because where are they going to go when they get done burying him? They're going to go right back down to Egypt, right? Remember, they left their little ones down there. They left the herds down there. There's this army that is surrounding them, that is escorting them here and back. They're going to go right back down to Egypt, right? And the question remains, will they come back? Will they return to the land? So this is the first dying wish that we get here in this chapter. It's Jacob, right? Jacob says, bury me in Hebron, bury me with Leah, bury me with my fathers, and this gets carried out. And then immediately there in verse 14, Joseph returns back to Egypt, right? He and his brothers and all who had gone up with him to bury his father, right? They go right back down to the land of Egypt. Now jump down with me down to verse 22, because we get the second dying wish down there in verse 22. We're going to come back to verse 15 in a minute. But verse 22, not only do we see Jacob's dying wish, but we see Joseph's dying wish as well. So down in verse 22, we fast forward several years. Now Joseph stayed in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. Joseph saw the third generation of Ephraim's sons, also the sons of Machir, the son of Manasseh, who was born on Joseph's knees. Joseph said to his brothers, I am about to die, but God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones up from here. So Joseph died, and at the age of 110 years, and he was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. In Egypt. Right? So Joseph returns to Egypt. Verse 14, verse 22, we see that he continues to live down there. He continues to thrive. He lives to 110 years old. Okay? Which is a very long time to live at this point in time, not as long as his father has lived, not as long as his father's fathers have lived, much as Jacob expressed to Pharaoh when he met him, but still a very long time. He's able to see not only his grandsons, but he's able to see his grandson's sons, right? To the third generation that he is able to see. And as Joseph knows that his days are coming to an end, and we don't know how many of the other brothers are left at this point in time, we see that he says to his brothers in verse 24, whether that means that Judah is alive, whether that means that Simeon is alive, whether it means maybe that Benjamin is alive, Benjamin is the youngest, he's the most likely one to still be living, or whether we're simply talking about the other members of the household, right? These are his kin, as it were, right? His relatives. As Joseph speaks to them, as he knows he's getting ready to pass off the scene, he says, this is what I want you to do. I want you to make sure that my bones make it back to the land of Canaan. Right? Exactly the same request that his father has asked for, right? Bury me back in the land. Get me back to where I want to be. But as he does it, he references that there's a specific reason why this is going to take place, right? I am about to die, but God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, right? Joseph knows the promises of God have to be kept. He understands that Egypt is now the place that God looked at Abraham and said, for 400 years, I'm going to stick them in a land, and they're going to live in a land that isn't theirs, and then I'm going to bring them back in, right? Joseph now knows this is that land. Jacob knew this is that land. And Joseph knows that if this is that land, then we're coming back up at some point in time, right? And you keep my bones for 400 years, right? You hang on to them for 400 years, and you bring me back up out of the land when you go. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 22 latches onto this and says this is an act of faith on Joseph's part. To look at the promises of God and to make a statement like this, a request like this, can come from nothing other than faith. It was sure in Joseph's mind that just as surely as they had returned to Egypt back in verse 14, as he had stayed in the land of Egypt in verse 22, as sure as those things happened, just as surely the children of Israel would leave the land of Canaan, leave and go back to the land of Canaan at some point in time. And he wants to make sure that he too is going to be buried in the land of promise there. It takes much longer, and it goes beyond our scope here this morning to see how this gets carried out. But this does, in fact, get carried out. In Exodus chapter 13 and verse 19, as Moses is getting ready to leave the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt, he says, hold on, before we go, we got to grab something, right? And he grabs the coffin, right? It's still been sitting there for 400 years, right? Moses knows where it is. Everyone seems to know where it is. And says, we got to take this thing. They take this, they carry this thing then throughout the entire wilderness wanderings, another 40 years on top of that. And it takes until Joshua 24:32 for them to bury Joseph in the land in Shechem, right? In the land that incidentally Jacob had promised that he was going to give to Joseph. It takes him all that time, which means that you're talking about the 400, roughly 300 and something plus years that it takes between the time that Joseph goes back to Egypt and the time that the children of Israel leave. It takes another 40 years on top of that as they wander through the wilderness. Then it takes the entire conquest of Canaan by Joshua's hands before Joseph ever gets buried in the land of Shechem. Joseph's bones are literally on some 400 years of journeying that he's sitting in this coffin. And it happens. It takes place. Joseph gets buried in the land of Canaan exactly as he promised, which will take us to what we'll look at later. We're talking about the faithfulness of God, right? It is on display. And Joseph's dying wish will, in fact, be carried out. And so as you end the book of Genesis, you are laying the foundation for a return to the land, right? You are laying a foundation in Jacob's death. You're thinking about the children of Israel needing to leave at that point, right? Not everyone is going to go up on that state funeral. You leave the little ones and you leave the flocks behind. But what happens when you get to the book of Exodus? You take those little ones and you take those flocks with you. That becomes a big point of contention as they negotiate with Pharaoh, right? You're thinking about the return to the land. You're thinking about them getting back in. You're thinking about them returning via that same route potentially. All right, as you see that state funeral, as it takes its journey up there, you're thinking about that return. And as you look at Joseph's dying wish there at the end of this book, you're thinking again about the book of Exodus. It practically leaps into Exodus chapter 1 because you can't wait. Will they get Joseph's bones to Egypt or will they not? Right, and it's beautiful the way that it's worded. These dying requests, these dying wishes lay the foundation for a return. Right? God has promised to Abraham, I'm going to send your seed down to live in Egypt for 400 years and I'm going to bring you back out after that. And you are waiting for it by the time you get to Genesis chapter 50. And you can't wait to get Exodus chapter 1. But we're not going there this morning. Okay? But that is exactly what it is setting us up for. The second foundation that we see in this chapter is a foundation of God's sovereignty. A foundation of God's sovereignty. If you go back now to verses 15 through 22, let's deal with the scene that we find here. In verse 15, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, what if Joseph bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong we did to him? So they sent a message to Joseph saying, your father charged before he died, saying, thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgressions of your brothers and the sin, for they did you wrong. And now please forgive the transgression of your servants, of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and for your little ones. So he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Verses 15 through 21 are honestly rather sad in almost every sense of the word. It's a tragic scene that takes place. It's an understandable scene that makes sense given the history that has taken place between Joseph and his brothers. But it lets you understand that the brothers don't seem to really understand what's going on still. Right? Joseph seems to understand what's going on, but the brothers don't seem to get it. So when you look in verse 15, you basically have the brothers trying to make sure that they're going to be safe for the rest of their life now that Jacob has passed off the scene. They seem to get around. They seem to start to think among themselves, we didn't do a good thing to Joseph at all. You know, we sold him down into slavery. He was very young when we did that. Things were not easy for him. I'm sure by this point, Joseph has relayed much of what would have happened to him in the land of Egypt, right? So you have the slavery that took place that they are directly responsible for. Then you end up with the time in prison that he has spent as Potiphar and his wife do Joseph wrong. Then suddenly you have that rise that takes place as Joseph then becomes the second in command in Egypt. But he must have related much of this to them, and they must have still felt some sort of guilt about this. And so in order to make sure, as you see, end of verse 15, that Joseph doesn't pay them back, they determine that they need to take steps to make sure that this doesn't take place, right? And so there's a message that they send in verse 16, quote-unquote, from Joseph's father. And I say quote-unquote because it's not clear to me, and I don't think it is, a message that Jacob ever sent to his son Joseph. As you look at this message, it seems to be something that is entirely concocted by the brothers in order to make Joseph feel guilty or in order to kind of hem Joseph and any of his grudges in, as it were. For one thing, you would think that this would come earlier, sometime in the book, right? You see several interactions that take place between Joseph and Jacob. You would think that maybe this would take place in chapter 48 when he's blessing his two sons. He would say, listen, now I know they did you wrong, but I'm going to bless these two boys, and you forgive your brothers, and it'll be okay. You would think it might come there. You might think that it would even come before verse 28 of chapter 49. Right after you get done with the blessings, and I know there's been some bad blood with you guys, but let's go ahead and calm this thing down. Let's not think about that ever again. Bygones are bygones, and so on and so forth, right? You would think that this would take place at some point. It seems weird that they have to send a message after the fact that Jacob is dead, that it would have really been from Jacob to begin with. The second thing that seems odd is verse 17. When he said, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. We never have any indication in the book of Genesis that the brothers ever fessed up to their father as to what they did. There's no record of it at all. In fact, it seems to largely be swept under the rug the entire time, right? Remember, they come up, they sell Joseph into slavery. They come back with Joseph's coat and present it before his father and said, you tell us what happened. It's covered in blood. He must have been eaten by something. Something must have happened to him, right? And meanwhile, they had sold him and don't say anything about it at all. When they come back, and they come back from the land of Egypt after they're getting the food and they say Joseph is alive, there's no mention at all of saying, by the way, he is probably alive because we actually sold him down there and he didn't get eaten by a lion. It's more left to Jacob's wonderment that his son is really still alive. Even when you see the reconciliation that takes place between Joseph and Jacob, there doesn't seem to be a catching up moment where Joseph says, by the way, do you know what these guys did to me? Like, this is awful. Do you know what they did? There seems to be no mention whatsoever that anyone ever tells Jacob, this is what happened to your son. As far as Jacob was concerned, he disappeared, something happened to him, and next thing you know, he pops up in Egypt, and that's just all there is to it, right? So it seems odd that this is the time that you would get some indication that Jacob knows what happened, right? This seems to be much more of the concoction of the brothers, where they get together, they say, listen, we need to try to apologize. We need to make sure that Joseph doesn't kill us. He is in charge. He is in command. He may have left us alone because he honored his father, right? Didn't want to bring any grief to Jacob. But now that Jacob's off the scene, it's fair game, right? It's hunting season now. Right, he can do whatever he wants to. And so this seems to be a concoction that they do. And it seems especially that way because they seem to almost overdo it, don't they? Right? They mention in verse 17, I beg you, forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. And then they say, and now please forgive the transgression of your servants. Then in verse 18, the brothers also came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. I mean, these guys are basically groveling in every sense of the word, right? Telling the father is supposedly saying, forgive them. They're saying, please forgive us. They're groveling down on their knees by the time you get to the next verse. They're overdoing it, I think, to a certain degree. And I think this explains a lot of what you see at the end of verse 17, where it says, and Joseph wept when he spoke to them. Joseph wept when he spoke to them. We don't really know why Joseph weeps, right? But we know that Joseph is weeping. And it seems to be a different weeping than takes place earlier when he sees his brothers for the first time, right? Or when he sees Benjamin again after all of these years. This seems to be a little bit different. Now, it's possible that part of this is the nearness of his father's loss, right? He's just lost his father, and maybe the thought that his father had sent him one more message kind of tears him up. Maybe he's thinking about his father at this point in time. Maybe this is just another reminder that, yes, my father has died, and it breaks him up in some way. But I think it is more likely that Joseph looks at his brothers and weeps because they don't understand him, and they don't understand the situation. Joseph has had plenty of times, if he wanted to do something to his brothers, he could have done it and carried it out. That entire time that he was playing with them down in Egypt. And again, I don't know the rationale. I don't know exactly. I still don't understand exactly why all that took place. But if Joseph really wanted to kill his brothers, if Joseph really wanted to do something to his brothers, couldn't he have done it then? And even if Joseph is that concerned about his father Jacob, he's second in command. He can do whatever he wants. He could have done something to them even as they were coming back from the land of Canaan. Right, that whole journey, he's got all these chariots and horsemen. He's got men at his command. He can order something whenever he wants to do it. But is that what Joseph wants? No, it's not what Joseph wants. It's never been what Joseph has wanted. We talked about the fact that even during all that time when Joseph is seemingly playing with his brothers, behind all of that is kindness. Behind all of that was goodness. It was free food. Right? It was finding out his brother. It was bringing his brother back down. It was making sure that his father was still alive and finding out about the health of his father. It was that kind of thing that is going on. Joseph has done everything that he possibly could to provide for his brothers. When they come down finally from the land of Canaan and they come to live in the land of Egypt, where does he set them up? He sets them up in Goshen. Right, he sets them in the best place possible for them. He has done everything that he can to make sure that they are taken care of. And he reiterates this again down in verse 21. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. So he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. This has been the heart of Joseph from the very beginning that they showed up in the land of Egypt. Right? He has wanted to provide for them. He has wanted to care for them. He has played with them, yes. He has messed with them, yes. But he has provided for them every step of the way. And he was put there. And he understands that he was put there to provide for them. And he's going to make sure that gets carried out. And so when his brothers come, and they come with this concocted message of trying to make sure that Joseph doesn't kill them or play out this grudge that he's had, I think he weeps because they don't understand him at all. They don't understand the situation. And furthermore, they don't understand what the place is. Verse 19, do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? I may be number two in Egypt. I may be in charge of an awful lot, but I'm not in God's place, right? I'm in this place right here, right? This is not my place to carry out judgment. It is not my place to carry out a sentence like this. This is not my role. Verse 20, as for you, you meant evil against me. But God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, in order to preserve many people alive. Joseph can see the bigger picture. And this is largely a restatement of what he said in chapter 45, when his brothers come back that final time and he says, I am Joseph. This is a more concise version of exactly that same thought that he expressed at that point in time, right? You meant this for evil. You meant to harm me. You did harm me. Right, but all of that took place solely for something good to come out as a result of that. God meant it for good. And this is the high water mark of Joseph's story. This is the point that everything has been building up to. It has been a point to say that even through the actions of men, the sovereignty of God is still in control. The sovereignty of God is still working. The sovereignty of God is still guiding and causing things to flow exactly the way that he wants it to be. In many ways, this is the flip of the way that you see things happen with Job, right? When you look in the book of Job, you see early on that God is doing this thing and he's allowing this thing to take place, and it takes everyone a while to catch up to it. Here in this book, you see all of these things unfold, and towards the end of the story, you realize this is what's been going on, right? God has been steering, he has been guiding, he has been causing this thing to move exactly the way that he wants it to go, and nothing can stop that. Not the sinfulness of men, not the difficulty of circumstances, not famine that is taking place. Nothing can disturb the plan of God. It is going to happen no matter what. It doesn't matter whether the individuals are sinful or whether they're righteous. It doesn't matter whether you're being thrown into good circumstances or bad circumstances. It doesn't matter what the intentions of the people are around you. If God wants to bring something to pass, he's going to bring something to pass, and he's going to make it happen. And Joseph can see this. Joseph understands this. And this is meant for us as well to understand, right? Moses is writing this for us. Joseph is speaking to us through this situation. He's saying, look at me, right? Look at my life. Look at everything that has happened to me. Has a lot of it been bad? Yes. Did my brothers mean evil against me? Yes. But can God bring something good through that? And the answer is absolutely yes, he can, right? And this reminds us as we look at life, as we look at circumstances that we find ourselves in, we are reminded that simply because people are ill-intentioned against us, just even if there are fears that are around us and there are threats that we are worried about, even if we find ourselves unable to do what we think we ought to be doing, or we find individuals around us doing things that they really ought not to be doing, does that in any way endanger the plan of God? And the answer is it does not, right? It does not bother the sovereignty of God one bit. He can work through good people. He can work through bad people. He can work through good intentions. He can work through bad intentions. He can work through good circumstances. He can work through bad circumstances. And he does. And he does, right? And this book shines with that illustration. It shines with that truth. It lays that foundation of what God's sovereignty looks like. It is not bound. It is not constrained by anything man can do. It is not constrained by anything that it finds itself surrounded by. It will continue to march forward, and nothing can deter it. And Joseph understood that. And his brothers couldn't. And I don't know why. Could they not look back as much as Joseph did and see this working out this way? Or is it simply their own guilt that obscures it for them? Right? They're so overcome with what they've done, they can't see this truth. And I think it's possible that may be another lesson for us out of this. That the truth of God remains firm. It's us that has a hard time understanding it. It's us that has a hard time seeing it. But the truth is there, right? If we're looking for it, if we're seeing it in Scripture, it is present. But it may be our own circumstances that prevent us from viewing it here. So these are the foundations that are laid, right? We see a foundation for Israel's return in the wishes of Jacob and Joseph. And we see a foundation of God's sovereignty here in this passage here. But I want to take for a minute to look at the faithfulness of God, because the faithfulness of God is what is wrapping all of these items up together. It is wrapping these items together. The first thing that I want to think about is this Exodus that we're thinking about here. Joseph mentions in verse 24 that Israel is going to one day return to the land, right? They're going to come back. He's going to send them back. And he's so confident about this, he is so sure about this, that he says, you put my bones in a coffin and you make sure that everyone knows where my coffin is, because in 400 years I'm going up, right? I'm going up with you, right? And what's critical in verse 24 is what he says at the end of verse 24. He's going to bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. This is what Joseph's faith lied in. Right? It wasn't just Joseph that was sitting there being the optimist. Right? Some people are the optimist. Right? They think everything is going to work out good. Everything is going to work out fine. My famous last words, it'll be fine. Right? This is me. There are some of us who are like this. This is not what Joseph is basing this off of. Right? This is not based off of some kind of inherent goodness that things will simply work out the right way. This is based off of something concrete. This is based off of an oath that God has made to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Joseph's faith is in the faithfulness of God. That if God makes a promise, that he will keep that promise. That there is nothing that can deter him, right? And if the sovereignty of God can be shown in his life to the way that Joseph has seen it to be, then even if it's 400 years later and individuals that this promise came to are long off the scene and are hardly remembered at that point in time, does that limit what God will do? It does not. Because he is a faithful God. If the covenant was made, if the promise was made to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob, then the promise will be fulfilled, even if those individuals are off the scene. Even if Joseph is off the scene. Even if Joseph's sons are off the scene. It doesn't matter, because the faithfulness of God is what is underpinning everything. When we look at the book of Exodus and we start to see everything that takes place in Exodus chapter 1, and you start to see the events that are unfolding, right? All the plagues that are taking place, the hardness of the heart The pursuit of Pharaoh and his army of Israel to the sea, and then the sea is opening up and the children of Israel are going through. As you watch all of that unfolding, what you're looking at is the faithfulness of God. A faithfulness that said, in 400 years, I will bring your descendants up out of this land. And Exodus is simply God carrying that out. And he's doing it spectacularly, right? It's shock and awe in every sense of the word, right? It is God's faithfulness on display, and Joseph knows it. It comes back to an oath that was made to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob there. But then also consider what Joseph is saying in verses 19 and 21. As he is discussing with his brothers why they should not be afraid, right? Why they should think about what is going on. When Joseph says down there in verse 19, "Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive." Joseph is looking, and I think Joseph is probably overwhelmed by the present result. The present result. What does Joseph mean by that? There's two things that have gone on in this chapter. One is that as you've looked at the life of Joseph, he has managed to keep a lot of people alive. Remember, this is a famine that is impacting all the world, right? This is not just a famine that impacts Egypt. This is not just a famine that impacts Canaan. This famine is seemingly worldwide at this point in time. If Joseph had not been raised up, there would have been a lot of people that were dead, would not have enough food to eat, would not have had any place to go, right? This is why the nations are flooding down to Egypt. They're flooding down to buy grain. Now, is that grain free? No. Is Pharaoh getting rich? Yes. But are they alive? Yes, they are. Right? We may question some of what's going on, but God is using it for that particular reason. Joseph is raised up for that particular reason. Many people are being left alive, are being kept alive because of Joseph's actions, right? Because of the seas of grain that he stopped numbering, right? Because they had 7 years of plenty. Because of those seas of grain that are in Pharaoh's storehouses, many people are left alive. That's part of what he's talking about when he's talking about this present result. What's the second part of that, though? Children of Israel are still alive as a result of this, right? The children of Israel are a subset of everyone else, but the children of Israel are a very important subset of that group of people, right? There was a promise that was made, and those promises have to be kept. And for that to take place, the children of Israel have to be alive, right? You can't go fulfilling these promises if all of the descendants have died off, right? That doesn't work. This isn't going to happen at that point in time. Joseph is thinking about these present results, and I think Joseph is overwhelmed by that. Turn back with me, if you would, to Genesis chapter 12, because I think this is probably part of what Joseph has in mind at this point in time. Genesis chapter 12. We're going back. This is a foundation, right, that was laid, a covenant that God is making with Abraham. Abraham is leaving the land where he came from. He's going to a place that he has no knowledge of. He's never been. He has no roots. He doesn't know anyone there. There's no reason for him to be there, right? You don't just go around traveling to these kind of places and living there for no reason, right? God has made a promise to him. Genesis chapter 12, verse 1. Now the Lord said to Abraham, "Go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the ones who curse you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth will be blessed." In that covenant, I think you find both of the elements that Joseph is talking about here, right? You find the reference to the children of Israel in verse 2, right? "I will make you a great nation, I will bless you, and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing," right? If the children of Israel had been allowed to perish in the land of Canaan because they didn't have enough food, could that promise ever come true? Answer is no, right? They could not become a great nation because they're all dead, right? There's no one to carry on the name. This couldn't happen. But then also consider the end of verse 3. "In you, all families of the earth will be blessed." Is that taking place through the life of Joseph? Very much is. This is what that sea of grain in Pharaoh's storehouses is doing, right? The children of Israel are leading to a blessing that is flowing out to all of the earth at this point in time, right? All of the earth is benefiting from Abraham's seed in some capacity. Is that the ultimate explanation for this verse? Ultimate fulfillment? No, it is not. But it's an awful good picture of what it looks like. Right? The ultimate fulfillment is Christ, right? The one who blesses all the families of the earth and that redemption that he brings, right? That goes to every tribe and tongue and people, as we saw in Revelation 5 last week. That's the ultimate fulfillment of this verse, where all nations will be blessed through him. But Joseph stands as a picture of what that looks like, right? This bounty that is being expressed is not reserved for Israel alone, but it is going to everyone. Everyone is experiencing the blessings that is coming from this. Right? This is a fantastic thing that is coming on. And so when you see in Genesis chapter 50 that Joseph is talking about this present result, God has organized this present result. The preservation of life that has taken place, both of the families of the earth and of the children of Israel, come down to the faithfulness of God of a promise that was made to Abram in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. Right? It is a fulfillment. It is God's faithfulness on display. Everything in Joseph's life has happened because of the faithfulness of God. The end result of Joseph's life, the goal that we were trying to get Joseph to put him in second in command, to keep these people alive, is the result of the faithfulness of God. This is what is going on. And this is what is so beautiful about the book of Genesis, is you see that God keeps those covenants no matter what. It doesn't matter whether the people in the land of Canaan are worshiping idols or not. Are they getting grain? Yes, they are. The goodness of God is raining on the just and on the unjust at this point in time. Why? Because of the faithfulness of God. Because he said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to cause this thing to happen. And it happens. God keeps his covenants. He keeps the promises that he has made, right? And this is why we entitled this series, The Foundations and Faithfulness. Because you see that faithfulness of God over and over again on display. He makes a covenant in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. And he keeps it. It looks different, right? It may not even be exactly what you expect, but you can see it being lived out, right? And so as we close up this study, as we close up this book, I hope you remember the foundations and the faithfulness of God that have been laid out for us, right? Because it is those things that we cling to. It is those things that build up our faith. These are not just stories that exist for us to remember. This is not just stories that exist to give your children something to do in Sunday school. Right, these are stories that exist to build up our faith, to cause us to see who God is, to cause us to believe in him more, to cause us to trust in the promises that pertain to us and to cling to him. Whether those are promises that were fulfilled long ago or whether those are promises that are yet to come in the future. Right, those foundations, that faithfulness that is on display is meant for us. And I hope it does that for us. Father, we thank you for what we see in this book. Father, I thank you that these are not just a collection of fairy tales. These are not just things that are long ago and far away. But these are truths that are meant to guide our lives even to this day. They guide moral decisions that we make. It guides our faith. It guides expectations that we have for the future. It governs and underpins everything that we know and we understand about Jesus Christ and everything that we know and understand about our redemption and our salvation. Father, everything that we need, that the seed of that is found in Genesis. And Father, I thank you also for the faithfulness that is on display here in this book. Father, as we consider the way that you work with men, is the way that you work through men, Father, to see that nothing can deter those promises, that there is no change in you, there's no deviation that you perform to say, I changed my mind, I don't want to do that after all. If you make it, it's firm, it's secure. Because again, when it comes to our salvation and it comes to resting in a covenant which you have made through your Son, Father, your faithfulness is everything that we want to know about, because that governs everything. And so, Father, I pray that as we think about this book, as we go our way and as Genesis starts to fade a little bit, Father, I pray that these thoughts, these themes stick with us, Father, and that as we go back to this book and as we read through it year after year, Father, that our thoughts and our mind are guided and directed back to you and back to these truths, and we remember these things. We thank you that you've given them to us. We thank you that you have bothered to preserve it, that you have kept it after all this time. And Father, I pray that we use it in the way that it's intended. Just in my prayer.